Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am delighted to welcome back into our studios for his monthly visit to the program, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, director of the renowned Clawson Center, author of After the Cold War. As any of you who listen to the morning show on a regular basis know very well, Professor Sear is with us once a month to offer his perspective and analysis, reflection on various issues that are pertinent both here and abroad. And there's a lot to talk about. So, Professor Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg, and especially the word renowned. Thank you in particular for applying that word to our work. Renowned is a great word, isn't it?
It is. So the Clawson Center, it's certainly a great enhancement to all that Carthage does. And
well, I'm so sure glad I showed up this morning. Thank you so much. You must be in a good mood.
Right, and I'm glad Mother Nature made your visit possible. There's a lot to talk about, and it's
you
a
mean
little
I'm
bit
still breathing.
Right.
No, it's sunny outside.
Yeah. So a lot to talk about, and it's really kind of difficult to know where to begin. Oddly enough, I think one of the places I feel like starting with is the what is going on across the country, namely the boisterous, turbulent interaction that is occurring at various town hall meetings across the country when legislators go back home and they will have hundreds of people showing up at town hall meetings and often their opposition rather than their own supporters. And it just strikes me as that not only are we a sharply divided country at the moment, that's no secret, but it does also seem like because of that intense division, it's also a time in which all kinds of people seem to be wide awake and really engaged in a lot of these issues that are confronting us right now. I mean, maybe more so than was once the case. I wonder if that's your sense as well, that for all that we might see as kind of a negative picture of kind of a nasty sense of divide in our country, that it's also a time in which many of us are caring about a lot of these issues maybe more than we did a few years ago, and maybe we felt like we had the luxury of being complacent.
Well, that's a very challenging question, especially because we're supposed to specialize in quick answers and short responses and sound bites. I guess not
on public radio.
Not on NPR. Quite right. No, that's kind of a philosophical question, isn't it? I will think about it. I think you're definitely onto something. That's my immediate instinctive reaction. The New England town meeting is the classic image of American representative government at work in a orderly and stable way, and you often see pictures in elementary and high school textbooks of the town meeting. Rough, raw, sometimes violent populism is also very much part of the American political tradition. Speaking of ancient history, when I was young, there was great concern about Americans becoming less and less engaged in politics and people not registering to vote and not voting. I haven't looked at numbers and charts lately, but I do believe levels of participation are quite high in this country, and you may be on to something important. Not surprisingly, Professor, because people do seem to be very actively engaged. Robert Putnam, a very accomplished senior Harvard professor, wrote a book that became a bestseller a few years ago called Bowling Alone. The American sense of community is breaking down. I'm sure that's true at some level, thanks to the decline of smaller towns and small communities and the decline of the family and other things that used to keep us stable. But volunteerism is a very strong theme in American life today, and that's actually growing, I think, in very dramatic ways. You and I have the advantage of being around very fine young people on an almost daily basis, and I'm impressed by the amount of volunteering that goes on among Carthage students who are very busy at a very challenging time in life. Katie Schlinder is a good example that I think of. She is an IP graduate. I know her because she was my advisee. She's forged ahead effectively in life, but she was so inspired by a trip she took to Central America, I think with Professor Ed Montanaro, that she went back on her own dime, a young person with student debt and working a job. All the challenges, as I said, and did some follow-up work at a rural fisheries center in Central America. That's not something that makes headlines, but it is a very strong part of our culture and British culture that's different from other countries, and it may be a basic advantage. Not that other countries don't have good qualities and virtues and lots of other active, productive aspects of life, but this notion of volunteering beyond the state and beyond the church is something that's a basic strength of this country.
Let's talk first domestically for a little bit, and then there's plenty to talk about in terms of what's been going on all around the world, including some important events and developments in the Far East, which I know is region of the world that you're especially interested in.
Easier questions, please.
Right, right. But let's talk closer to home. First of all, your armchair quarterback perspective on the presidency of Donald Trump thus far. Has much about it surprised you, delighted you, repulsed you? What is your reaction thus far in terms of how President Trump is governing us thus far, those in his inner circle who have been entrusted with the most important responsibilities?
I've been pretty blunt on my own personal opinion of him as a person as well as presidential contender. Herb Bloch was a very influential political cartoonist and a very strong kind of New Deal, Fair Deal Democrat from an earlier era. He was particularly hostile to Richard Nixon, and who was always a very controversial figure from the beginning to the very end, and would draw Nixon as congressman, senator, and vice president climbing up out of a sewer with his 5 o'clock shadow and mean, you know, sort of like looking like one of Satan's offsprings with a bucket full of mud or something even more disagreeable. And when Nixon became president in 1968, this very influential cartoonist gave him a shave and put him in a business suit and made the point at some length for a cartoon that whenever someone becomes president, the not only the office deserves respect, but the individual deserves a chance, and I think that's a very healthy way to look at things.
So you're endeavoring to do that, then?
I'm succeeding, obviously. More specifically, we have a kind of schizophrenic administration. Our president tweets out nonstop. The first daily tweet president I think we've had. At the same end, often is given to statements that anyone, even his strongest supporters, would admit was, or state was rather extreme. At the same time, senior administration officials seem to be conducting business as usual, not only during the campaign, but since the inauguration, as one example. Trump was very critical of NATO and established institutions and everything else. One might think of Samson or King Kong, depending on your positive or negative view of him. Secretary Mattis, the Pentagon, and Vice President Pence and others have gone to Europe for major conferences, and they've reiterated traditional policy. And there are other examples that one might cite. So far, I guess it's still coming together.
Of course, big news today is that the revised travel bans enacted by the President Trump by executive order have been challenged in two different courts, which essentially freezes them in their tracks until they can be further explored. And of course, this is kind of a repeat of the of the first set of travel bans, which met with a similar obstacle in the judicial wing. So, what is your sense of what's going on here and what's likely to go on here? I mean, is it possible to put together anything like what President Trump is proposing and trying to enact, or is this likely to replay again and again? And what is the issue? I mean, what is he trying to do that is found to be so objectionable by these federal judges that they are not allowed to go forward?
Well, you have to operate within the law, and I'm not a lawyer or a constitutional expert or an immigration expert, but we are a system based on law that used to be pretty distinctive among countries, including industrialized nations. And one of the positive developments of the 20th century, after all the blood and carnage, is more and more nations are committed to the rule of law. And even a very assertive president, to put it politely, ultimately has to defer to the courts, and that's nothing new. The George W. Bush administration, their most significant controversy, I believe, was after 9/11, after the Guantanamo base was turned into a prison, an interrogation center for suspected terrorists and members of sympathetic organizations. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said, in effect, these people are nothing. They're not uniformed military personnel, which the Geneva Conventions, especially in the late 40s, very clearly defined as necessary to be treated under international law concerning war, something that's evolved over centuries, thanks especially to the Roman Catholic Church, and has been very important in this country, starting with the Civil War, thanks to Abraham Lincoln. They are nothing. They're not armed combatants. They're not American citizens. We don't have to apply the Constitution. It took a while, as usual, but the U.S. Supreme Court, a conservative court, basically was very, very clear that you have to have at least habeas corpus and the right to appear before a judge, no matter who you are, something firmly rooted in Anglo-Saxon law as well as tradition, British law. You have to. You have the right, no matter who you are, to appear before a judge and say face to face, I'm guilty or not guilty. You have to have the right to confront your accusers face to face, and you've got to have some kind of orderly procedure. You can't just have Rumsfeld imperiously making declarations from the Pentagon, in some ways comparable to the current style of the president. And this goes on and on through history in this country. And so I think we're having more of the same in that sense. I must say you're asking challenging questions. It's not just because it's early in the morning. But
well,
that's my best answer. At the same time, there's another dimension. It's a part of, sorry to go on for so long, but that's me. I was up at St. Norbert College, a very fine Catholic institution, just up the road in De Pere next to Green Bay,
right,
representing Carthage College, and they'd also invited me to come up to give two talks and meet with some of the people there.
St. Norbert's a great school.
Which I was glad to do, yeah. And there's a rather nice hotel right next to the campus, and I was sitting in the breakfast room with a couple of working guys. I think that maybe they were concert violinists, but they seemed like two regular guys, working people. And one said to the other, "What did you think of President Trump's speech?" And the other one said it was great. And then they kind of went back and forth on just how terrific this president is, and with some satisfaction mentioned the news, you know, the news media is really giving him a bad time. One guy, the other guy said, "Yeah, but they're going out of business. The news means less and less." I believe President Trump is a genius, and I clearly am not. I don't know about you, but in terms of understanding, appealing to, and manipulating a vast mass of Americans who work for a living, and by all indications, they're not going to benefit from this administration, especially given the early summary reports on the new budget, and the Republican health care plan. So I think, as a media politician, he continues to be very, very effective and very, very positive. We live in a privileged world in academia, and it's really good to get out of the great world behind the walls you and I live in, Professor, most
right.
of the time. There's a great world out there, and in many ways it's very different from the environment in which we operate.
Right, and of course, to be a politician at the national level particularly, and be out of touch with that.
Well, you're going to lose.
Yeah, I mean, and so we saw the way that worked out. Let's talk for a moment about the repeal of the Affordable Health Care Act and the way that this intense discussion is unfolding, and of course the real challenge that that is faced by those that are putting forth this Republican alternative, not only from Democrats across the aisle, but in a sense more seriously from some within their own ranks. Who take exception to it in one way or another. Has anything been striking to you in terms of the way this is playing out right now and the kinds of things that are being talked about or the way in which these arguments are being framed?
A lot of the initial reaction in the mass media, especially the electronic media, but also the print media, including the Wall Street Journal, regarding the Republican health care plan, is the degree to which it will raise costs for people who don't have a lot of money. I haven't studied the plan in detail, but it underscores how easy it is to denigrate the other side's proposals and a law that they've passed, but how really difficult it is, especially in the vexing area of health care, to come up with a proposal of your own that will get through and work. It shows how divided the current Republican Party is. An awful lot of House Republicans and a couple of senators are the main critics of what the House leadership has come up with. And finally, we've had politics is always roiling and involves troubled waters, but the waters have been very calm for the last 8 years between the executive and legislative branches in terms of legislation because, in my view, after the Affordable Care Act was passed, the Obama administration became inert in terms of initiatives at the top involving legislation through Congress. It's not much discussed. A lot of the media is very sympathetic to President Obama. I'm very glad still that I voted for him, but there was zero, I mean zero, legislative leadership. So the lack of activity, a lack of momentum, Trump, who has no actual political experience in terms of elective politics in the public sector, I think has a major challenge, even though it's a different party. He also has an opportunity, but so far we haven't seen any indication that another celebrity politician, and that describes both him and Obama in terms of how they got to the top. There's no indication yet that he's actually able to lead in terms of dealing successfully with Congress, and that's something to keep an eye on.
Right.
Beyond all the rhetoric, beyond all the basically hostile attitudes toward Trump as a personality, which is what these two working guys were actually getting at with some satisfaction. I think serious people like us should keep, and all your listeners, or almost all, and that's what we should keep an eye on, is this guy actually an executive? His predecessor was not. The last really talented deal maker was Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. That was now a while ago, buddy.
Right. You know, we may have talked about this once before, but I remember hearing a guest on some public radio program talking about how one of the biggest challenges that President Trump faces in terms of making deals is the fact that he comes almost entirely, pretty much entirely from the business sector, where when you are trying to make a deal for whoever's going to manufacture your shirts or who's ever going to build your next golf course, whatever, but you're going after the very best deal that you possibly can for yourself. And in a sense, you want to get as good a deal as you possibly can. And in a sense, you don't care what the other guy feels like. And in many cases, you have winners and losers in those kind of deals. And when it comes to, in a sense, more diplomatic kind of deals, whether you're trying to forge a deal between nations or whether you're trying to forge some kind of cooperation with Congress, you have to be able to broker deals in which you aren't the winner and they are the loser. Mm-hmm. That it is a very different kind of deal making that we're talking about here, and the question is, first of all, does President Trump understand that, and what is his what are his capabilities for brokering those kind of deals, in which even the person who maybe gets the short end of the stick doesn't feel like they ended up with nothing, doesn't end up feeling like a loser, because that can be really damaging to a deal being made at all.
I don't think I agree with your premise. The most successful.
It's not mine. It's someone else was suggesting this parallel, but anyway.
Okay. even though you distance yourself from what you just said.
Well, no, I'm just saying this is not my idea. It's someone else's idea that I heard on public radio.
In my limited experience, the most successful long-term executives and leaders are people who confront conflict when you have to. But the ideal deal, from my point of view, is one where both sides win or both sides get something. You avoid making an enemy, and there's benefit for both sides or as many people as possible. Trump, the businessman, is actually a term that's most accurately applied to Mr. Trump, Frank Trump, the president's father, who in many ways uniquely rough and ruthless real estate environment of New York City, including the boroughs and the Northeast generally, he made a huge fortune in that very, very difficult, challenging business. It's extremely important for the president to be seen as a businessman. That's undeniable. His business career was quite dramatic, marked by at least two almost unbelievably huge bankruptcies. He did make money in 2005. He made some millions in money, just reported in the media, and Trump immediately stole the thunder from that, very, very skillfully, as usual, with the White House preempting the news story and making it non-news. I've never had any indication that he's actually a businessman. He's a show businessman. He made a great deal of money in the internet, and that's a very, very rough business as well. Yeah. And The Apprentice, I don't think I ever actually watched that program, ivory tower professor that I am, or maybe I just have good taste. But, I mean, he made a lot of money off of that show, and I think it's now gone. But he's not a businessman.
Hmm. Interesting.
I first became aware of him in a direct sense in 1996-97. I spent 2 years running the World Trade Center organization in Chicago. And I was glad to do it, and I'm very grateful to Neil Hardigan, Illinois former government official and politician. They were in some financial difficulty. I'm very proud of the fact that we got them out of trouble. When I left, there was money in the bank. All the big bills had been paid, and nobody had been fired. We got money from Gary, Indiana, which had a lot of cash from gambling and a lot of trouble, and very few people were actually raising money in Gary, at least on the right side of the law. Scott King, a longtime lawyer in Northwest Indiana who happens to be a Caucasian, was the mayor, very successful mayor of this 85% plus African American community. He made it possible for me to meet payroll, which I never missed. But it was very, very close. I was just about ready to dip into my own funds when Mayor King's contract came through. His predecessor had opened the door for Trump to build casinos in Gary, and Trump got a lot of money out of the state of Indiana. I think I saw his oversized yacht in Lake Michigan on one occasion, but that may just have been a dream. I do know his oversized airplane landed regularly. He took Indiana for a lot of money. He took Gary for a lot of money. Nothing, and I mean nothing, was done. Hotel was going to be no renovation. Miss United States, yeah. Well, the young ladies came. They spent their time shopping in Michigan Avenue. Nothing of consequence happened except the community lost a lot of money. Now, I promise not to say any. I'm just talking about the deal and what actually happened in the deal. It's not a business deal. It's not anything except a guy who fleeced people.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting and important to keep in mind currently. On the upside, you're involved in music. The Music Man is one of my favorite light operas, and it's based geographically in Indiana, and a rather lighthearted version of a similar kind of character who was redeemed at the end.
Mm. So,
yeah, the hustler, the music instructor, who was a con man, but thanks to a good woman, his character was reformed and redeemed.
Mm.
A wonderful story, especially for public radio listeners, I should imagine.
But those of you just joining us, we have Dr. Art Sear joining us for his monthly visit to the morning show. Let's talk about Russia. And, of course, the questions
that
continue.
Why not? Everybody else is.
And questions, of course, continue to swirl around the questions about what did Russia do and when did they do it and who knew about it and so on. And, of course, the repercussions of that include, I think since your last visit to the morning show, the resignation of one of President Trump's top national security advisors, Michael Flynn.
Yeah.
Right. And, of course, also some controversy then around Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was essentially pretty much compelled to recuse himself from the official investigations involving Russian contact with figures in the Trump campaign staff and so on, and questions about whether or not Attorney General Sessions actually committed perjury in testifying before Congress. So really serious questions. You actually wrote a column about Russia in which you cautioned us, in a sense, to not go overboard and not, in a sense, fall prey to kind of an exaggerated fears
mm-hmm.
over just what Russia has been involved in or what this contact has been. I want you to talk about your sort of central concern there. What are people overreacting to? Why is this not as big a deal as some would make it out to be?
I believe the headline was "The Russians Are Not Coming," unless you happen to read a column where the editor changed the
yeah, I think
title, as they often do.
Right.
Yeah. Russians clearly hacked the Clinton campaign. And our intelligence agencies, I was rather nonplussed, and I'm sorry to see intelligence becoming so publicly politicized in terms of the partisan debate. I would have been happier if they'd said nothing, or at least issued a brief joint statement without having the furor and publicity of a big press conference and a big press statement. Yeah, Russians were involved. I think it probably was Putin. That's nothing new. I think the basic lesson is you should be very, very careful about what you put in writing. I remind students and others and myself regularly that the internet is public information in effect. It's certainly not secure. I'm sure your bank site is secure, but intelligence agencies, especially the National Security Agency, on our side, can hack whatever they want. Basically, there is no such thing as a secure phone. Keep that in mind. I was astonished that the Clinton people were so foolish and simple-minded as well as arrogant as to put all kinds of things in these emails. That's the real lesson. I think President Obama, from the time the story broke, handled it very well, including his rather lengthy discussion at, I believe, his last press conference. We made this information public. I think if there's anyone who was guilty of anything in this, it was the Clinton campaign for being so unbelievably arrogant and stupid. I don't know what to say beyond that. Other countries are always making mischief. Russia is, in many ways, we've been demonizing Russia now for some years, at least since the turn of the century. Two countries have a lot in common, in effect, in terms of the national interest of the U.S. and our general interest in stability and destroying terrorist groups. The Russians and the Syrians are doing a very good job of destroying ISIS. I don't believe we've had a coherent policy in terms of our government, not under Obama and not now, concerning what we should be doing in Syria. I think we're making some very unwise moves. I think there is elsewhere. There are opportunities for us to collaborate in pure national and international security terms with Russia. Putin is demonized. I don't think the alternative to Putin would be a Russian Barack Obama. I think democracy has no deep roots or traditions in Russia. I don't think communism is coming back, but I can very easily imagine a very scary and much more aggressive fascist militarist regime in Russia if Putin should go down. Hmm. I think these are realities to keep in mind, and we're much too inclined to, not just in academia, deliver moral lectures. And for political reasons, I think it's useful to both parties to make Russia, turn Russia into some kind of scary bear. But that's not the reality from my point of view.
Right.
I realize I'm kind of a minority in this area and as others, but that's at least my opinion.
Mm. Let's move on to the WikiLeaks revelations or purported revelations. I don't think the content has been really completely confirmed or not, but in terms of the vast activities of the CIA, in terms of what I've seen in the media described as their hacking division, and the hundreds and hundreds of let's call them tools that supposedly the CIA has been involved in terms of trying to create all kinds of means for hacking into phones and hacking into computers.
Well, that's what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, right. Did that come as a surprise to you? I mean,
nothing surprises me anymore. I don't know what's happening.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, was that even news to you that the CIA is engaged in this kind of activity to this extent? I mean, to the extent that they're figuring out how to hack into Samsung phones and not telling Samsung about it and so on.
Right.
Was that business as usual? We're just finding out about it.
If there's a concern, from my point of view, I think there's. I am concerned and worry about the fact that we give so much emphasis to technological, as opposed to human intelligence. Americans are always more comfortable with the technological means, whether it's an exciting new, very powerful, an efficient machine, or the latest fascinating gizmo from Popular Mechanics. Human intelligence is something we're not so good at historically. Our British friends are. One reason why we did so incredibly well, both the British and ourselves especially, in World War II, in both main theaters and around the globe, in effect, was because, thanks to them, we put tremendous emphasis on human intelligence. William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, in his case, a very positive nickname, the first director of the director of the first serious American intelligence agency, the OSS, Office of Strategic Services in World War II, brand new agency that FDR basically initiated, along with General Marshall, was he worked hand in glove with the British, and a very fine portrait of Donovan is still in the entryway, very much honored at the CIA headquarters. Outside Washington, we really need to do what we can to learn about how and make up our own minds about how well our government is doing in the human intelligence side. To actually answer your question, by all means, we should give emphasis to technology. Starting with Clinton and the budget cuts after the Cold War, for understandable political reasons, he cut human intelligence much more aggressively than electronic intelligence. The CIA is only one of a series of actors, the least public, the NSA, which I mentioned before, I think is probably still the most sophisticated and pervasive of our intelligence agencies. And it's important to keep in mind that it is pervasive. Starting in the 1950s, when the NSA was established, they could listen to anybody's phone conversation they wanted to. The CIA is prohibited by law from conducting their activities within the United States. And one reason the Nixon administration got in trouble was that starting with the Johnson administration, they had been doing so. The assistant chief of staff for intelligence of the United States Army in 1967 decided that the communist threat had become so serious. He'd become so preoccupied with subversion at home linked to the anti-Vietnam War movement that the agency began a very, that the Army began a very extensive domestic surveillance program, which is also quite against the law. And that was, it's one reason that congressional hearings into this general subject in the 1970s, led by Frank Church, an ambitious younger Democratic senator from Idaho, got so much publicity. And so point number one, it's nothing new. Point number two, the CIA has to be very, very careful since that time concerning what they do in the U.S. Outside of American citizens within our borders, I'm not quite sure why people are so concerned. Why should we be so concerned that the CIA is so effective at electronic means? I'm asking you for a change. Why should we be so concerned? Isn't right. that what they're supposed to be doing?
Well, at 12 minutes before the 9 o'clock, I would not venture to answer such a. But it's a great question.
Yeah, no, I mean, the man I was referring to, General Yarbrough. Sure. I mean, he shouldn't have been doing that. Like Flynn, you don't become a general unless you're very, very able then or now. But my own personal view was, and my view from a distance regarding Flynn is. You know, some men, after achieving a very senior position, things start to go wrong. And under the pressures of senior military command, that can happen. Clearly, Flynn kind of went a bit wacky before he was forced into retirement. And we're all fortunate he's not in Washington. And I think that's nothing new.
Right. Let's talk about a couple of things around the globe in our last few minutes.
I will say I think General McMaster is a great choice as National Security Advisor.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm not just slamming generals. McMaster, I think, is a brilliant choice.
Right.
And I'm glad he's going to be there advising the president.
Very good. There were elections in the Netherlands yesterday,
right.
And the results of those elections were essentially a repudiation of a right-wing candidate that had been looking very powerful in recent weeks, and I've heard this election in Holland characterized as one of several important elections occurring in Europe. I think France is one of the next ones in which it's in a sense sort of a litmus test for this new rise of populism and right wing attitudes regarding immigrants and so on. How should we be interpreting these events in a relatively tiny little country like the Netherlands? Does it really matter in the big picture?
Well, the Netherlands is not a tiny country in economic and financial terms, but
right.
of course, yeah, they did have a big empire. But it's important. It's not just me being academic. The British and the Dutch were, along with the French, were very important. The British and the Dutch were and are extremely important supporters of the United States economically until fairly recently. If now, they were the two biggest foreign investors. In the 1600s, more or less, the Dutch decided to give up, no longer compete with the British militarily, give up their gigantic navy and really focus on making money. They're an extremely important country. They've been an extremely important moderate leader in the movement toward European integration. All that by way of long-winded prologue to actually answer your question. Yes, it's good that far-right movements have overall been losing in Europe, given the tremendous controversy, strong emotions, bluntly racism, and ethnocentrism that characterizes every country. The United States of America, not so much, but these European countries are far more monolithic. I think it's fantastic that, led by Chancellor Merkel of Germany, they've been as welcoming as they have been to immigrants. Geert Wilders, the right-wing leader you're referring to, who lost, he's not the next Adolf Hitler. Since Adolf Hitler, we've always been looking for the next Adolf Hitler in Europe. The press has been saying that Marine Le Pen, the leader of the right-wing populist movement in France, her chances in the presidential election are limited. And I think that's probably true. But she's not the next Adolf Hitler. Her father, who was often depicted as a Nazi and fascist, and quite irresponsibly, I think, he was a French patriot and nationalist, to be sure, a paratrooper who, like a lot of the rest of the French military of his generation, suffered terribly in Indochina. I'm glad he wasn't elected, but even if he had been, it wouldn't have been the end of the Fifth Republic in France. Symbolically, especially because of the Dutch punch above their weight economically and commercially, and I think that's what I've been struggling to actually say, it's symbolically significant that this has happened, just as any election in Austria is important. Another small country, but with a far uglier past.
Right, and we shouldn't underestimate the significance.
You never know what's going to happen in Austria, but the symbolism, therefore, is really important.
Right, very good. Let's give you a chance to talk about the fact that the president of South Korea, the first woman leader of South Korea, was forced out of office due to corruption charges, and I think she's soon to go on trial. I'm trying to remember what I feel like you have said positive things about her in the past, and certainly in the context of all that South Korea has managed to accomplish. So what is your reaction to the sort of political ruin in which she finds herself in?
Well, certainly her career has been ruined. She is the first woman president of Korea of South Korea. Korea has a very, very rich and important history, and more than one significant woman ruler in Korea made a mark. But not lately. Her father was a very effective leader, to be sure, a very autocratic dictator who was in power for a number of years. He became so frightening, even to his own comrades at the head of Korean intelligence, an agency that has very close ties to our own intelligence agencies, military and civilian. The head of the Korean CIA, in effect, killed him, assassinated him. Given that in 1979, given that history, I think what I may have said on your program is she really personifies not only gender equality, but also the strength of democracy and a very positive leader. But she never asserted herself as a strong executive. I think probably she's a rather limited person, and she had very bad judgment. I don't think that there's any evidence she's personally corrupt, but she had a very close, lifelong female friend, a very close friend, who seems to be guilty of almost shocking amount of bad judgment and corruption and hunger for money. The fact that they impeached the president, and we know how painful a process that can be, and removed her, and she probably will be tried. I think, as with Richard Nixon, it would be wiser if they didn't, but it's their country and it's their business. That's the background, but the system has worked. A country that until the 80s was a very harsh dictatorship is now they're clearly rooted in democracy. It tends to be kind of a wild democracy, though, even compared to Washington, very raucous. They still occasionally have had physical encounters in the Korean parliament. It's always interesting. They're, as you know, they're, I believe, one of our most important allies, not only in Asia, but in the world. I mean, South Korea has a powerful sense of military. It's like a relative, a very powerful sense of not just alliance, but fraternity and family with the U.S. That's at their family. I met ROK soldiers in the U.S. Army, and they're not only men you want to have on your side, I assure you. They're not only ferocious warriors, but they really have this intense commitment to the U.S., for which we can thank Harry Truman and the way the Americans came to their rescue in 1950 in the Korean War.
I appreciated that actually in a column about Japan and to a lesser extent also mentioned in a column about Australia and our connection with each of those countries, you made such a good point about how in the worldwide economic downturn that we all are, of course, very well acquainted with, that one of the things that was most crucial to kind of the overall recovery, slow but sure, of course, was the strength of the economic sector in Asia, and the fact that they were a bit maybe less affected by that worldwide downturn was really significant in the fact that that the whole system sort of remained upright in a sense, and That's exactly the kind of point that, of course, never makes the headlines, but is, you know, probably can't exaggerate the importance of something like that.
Yeah, it's been a benefit throughout the region. The system has survived in South Korea. President Park has been president in an economy that is a phenomenal, perhaps unequaled success story. South Korea had the lowest per capita income, except maybe for Burma or one or two other countries in the world, around 1960. And I've noticed they're now coming up. I think they're back among the. They had a brief blip during the Asia financial crisis of the late 90s, but they're now back up among the top 10 economies in the world. She has had an unfortunate experience, and as you indicated, may well be tried and convicted and go to jail. But democracy does better when the system overall is strong. Japan Asia generally avoided the 2008 housing crash and financial recession, which began in the United States. And I think the fact that we have a global economy, but regions still differ dramatically, is very, very significant. I think Japan has an institutional strength, has an experience with advanced industrial economic life, and has, like South Korea, in a different way, such a strong affinity for the United States that our alliance will only become closer. Prime Minister Abe, in contrast to President Park, a very, very successful long-term politician, it took a lot of work to get first in line to visit the new President Trump. All the moves he's made and the fact that he's been able to survive for 4 years, I believe, and was in office before, for a long time, a handicap for Japan was every year or so there was a new guy in Tokyo, and the new guy was not often, for us, indistinguishable in policy from the predecessors. Abe has a phenomenal accomplishment, established a very strong position at home, is slowly opening the economy. President Woodward at Carthage is to be greatly commended, I believe, for emphasizing one, internships, and two, more involvement with Asia, focused understandably on China. But the opportunity for us is much more general throughout the region.
Yeah, it's an important part of the world, and we're maybe finally starting to wake up to just how significant it is. So,
well, Japan, Abe is very good at he's a very good American style PR politician, which is a big change in that country, but it's greatly strengthened his ability to have an impact in the world.
Well, on that note, we have to finish out. It's been a lively conversation. We've touched on a whole plethora of issues. I sure think so.
Well,
and look forward to your visit in April, when I suspect once again there'll be no shortage of important issues and questions for us to be wrestling with. Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. I always enjoy every experience of speaking with you on the morning show, and I thank you for joining me today once again.
Well, thank you.